Okay.
Let's do some music. I'm ready.
Yeah, interesting stuff this month. Just speed me up if I'm taking too long here. But yeah. So we have what I'm assuming.
Brian, can you speed up?
Already? All right. Light speed. Let's get to it. No, so unassumingly, this is probably going to be the most successful album of the year because it's also one of the most successful albums of all time. Norah Jones releases Come Away With Me. Do you guys know who Norah Jones is?
Mm-hmm. Vaguely.
What were the big hits from this one?
I believe there's a song in here called Come Away With Me.
Okay, good.
I listened to it a bunch, but not enough to write down the individual singles that I liked. But yeah, you know, she's 22. She's from New York. She is the daughter of Ravi Shankar. So I'm sure that he helped probably get her hooked up with some stuff. But not just nepotism. She's incredibly talented. So yeah, 27 million copies. Unbelievable.
Goddamn.
That's crazy sales for her to be putting up. And the album is essentially... So it was released on Blue Note Records. And Blue Note Records has been around for, I'm going to assume, the 40s-ish? I know during the 50s, they were a really big record label for jazz. And have consistently released jazz music. So it's kind of interesting that Norah Jones is there, because you don't really think of her when you think of jazz. She's more of like a soothing coffee shop, like folk artist, I guess you could say. And that's pretty much what the album consists of. It's very much sort of jazz pop, if that. But again, it's very much got that like very hushed, quiet music, very gentle, with a lot of like piano and upright bass. And, you know, all in all, just a very warm and like cozy blanket of a record. And the most important thing is, of course, her voice. Like, her voice is fucking incredible. And she's very forward in the mix, so you really get to hear a lot of what are those things that they do on YouTube, like the ASMR. You get that really in-depth hi-fi listen to her voice and to see just how lush it is and how beautiful she sounds. So really, really a good record. I can see why this just has universal appeal. People would really love it. And yeah, I mean, again, we were just talking about Jack Johnson releasing an album, John Mayer releasing an album, and this is probably in the vein of something like a Joni Mitchell or James Taylor. Like, I would absolutely recommend you listen to this record. Very, very good one. Worth revisiting and worth those sales.
James Taylor, he shreds.
Sure does.
Like we've established on this podcast before.
Oh, yeah. You know, like lights his guitar on fire and after shows and stuff. It's can't hold the man down.
So what I'm hearing is that Norah Jones should be in the next Animal Crossing soundtrack.
Yeah, I don't know. Like her and KK could do some crossover tracks.
Yeah, that'd be good.
As long as she does the same like bleep blorpy voice he does.
Of course.
You know. Do you guys have a favorite KK track?
No, I don't think so.
No.
Bubblegum Pop and KK Surfin' are my two favorite for sure. The Bossa Nova track is also really, really good. Just putting that out there. Mountain Goats. Mountain Goats is a guy named John Darnell. He's on his sixth album at this point. His album is called All Hail West Texas. You gotta love that title. That's a really great title. You know, and as hi-fi as that Norah Jones album is, this is about as lo-fi as you can get. He literally recorded it on a boombox. It is a very... People really do love lo-fi aesthetics when it comes to music, and this album is to the T, very much that. 14 tracks in 40 minutes. It's all about a group of high school kids growing up in Texas. Specifically West Texas, I guess, as you can imagine from the title. He is a very good songwriter. His voice is very nasally, but it's also kind of a charm to it. And his stories are interesting, and his melodies are fantastic. I think people that just listen to it for the first time might think this lo-fi, hear this lo-fi aesthetic and think this is cheap, and think this is not how someone who is on their sixth album should be recording an album. I get that. But what he made is fundamentally sound songs with beautiful melodies, really interesting stories. I came away really liking this record a lot, even if at first it was just sort of like, okay, I get it. And it's not as... it's not quiet or distant in its lo-fi-ness. It is very warm and inviting. You could hear like the tape click behind it too. When as tracks bleed into each other and he's not making any real noise, you can kind of hear the ambience of the room he's recording in. It's very, very interesting. Very cool record. A guy named Damien Rice releases his debut record. He's going to make a bunch of records. He's from Ireland, singer-songwriter. Never really knew the guy that much, but he's very much in the vein of David Gray. He had this one album produced song or had songs that appeared on 37 different movies and TV series over a 5-year period.
Okay.
He was like fodder for like those WB dramas. You know, like at like the 30-minute mark of any episode of a WB show, they go into a montage with a sad song. It was one of this guy's tracks. I really enjoyed it. It's not as mopey. Everyone was saying this album is just so sad and melancholy, and it really isn't. I think it's actually, maybe, and I'm not sitting there listening that closely to what he's saying, probably some sad content in the lyrics, but all in all, it's a very pretty record. Alanis Morissette, she releases Under Rug Swept. So it's weird to say that, because this album's going to sell 4 million copies, which for anybody is great, but this is kind of marking her downfall in a way. This is her last album that will go platinum, and not for lack of trying. She's going to make about 6 more records after this, including one that came out last year that just didn't get any promotion or publicity or play, like none of it. At any rate, so she is famous for like Jagged Little Pill. She had a ton of big hits. We all probably know like Ironic and all of those other songs. She was very emblematic of like the Gen Xers. And I think that just I like to look at the history of it all. At this point in history, I feel like this is really where millennials are taking over. I think millennial culture in 2002 is now really pushing the Gen X, who always had their voice kind of snuffed out, really pushes them further back. And I think that Alanis Morissette's message kind of struggles to deliver with maybe what people in the millennial culture want to hear.
How far removed are we from Jagged Little Pill at this point in 2002?
I think Jagged Little Pill, if I remember correctly, was in 94. So not that long ago. And she also had an album between that sold very well, too.
You know, it's
But Jagged Little Pill was one of those records that I want to say sold like 20 million copies. It was crazy, crazy successful.
You know, we don't have to get into, like, my own views on generational wars.
Yeah.
In particular, right now. But there is a sort of, like you're saying, there is a transition that happens between millennial culture taking over and Gen X sort of phasing out. So they're no longer the young cutting edge group, you know. I'm sure they didn't mind. It seemed like their motto, just basically as a generation, was ugh, whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm sure they're fine with this.
Oh, I think that's totally her angle, is that she's very not nihilistic, that's probably not the right word, but she's, you know, she's very much like unapologetically real and just talks about things in a matter-of-fact manner.
Well, there was a sort of like nihilism in Gen X. You can see a lot in like the, when we talk about like things like movies, like pre-9/11, like movies and pop culture. Yep. There's a sort of a nihilism or quiet desperation to a lot of things, like where we feel like as a society we've kind of we've already peaked and now we're going to be on the downside of it. And
yeah,
like Gen X in particular doesn't really have a particular struggle that they don't have something like a war or a civil rights movement that they were very deeply involved in. Like Gen X, you don't really think of them as having like a cause.
It's kind of like, I mean, you know, the silent generation, that generation before the great generation.
Yeah, Joe Biden's generation.
Right. It's true.
Don't give me that look, Wes. He is old. That is fact.
I believe you.
But I feel like that's kind of where the Gen Xers are. They're between these two big bubbles of population growth, and they're just kind of in the shuffle there. And they're often overlooked. So
yeah, it's true. Like, or were not nearly as big a generation as baby boomers. They were outnumbered by the baby boomers. So as they were supposed to be like inheriting the world, like no, the baby boomers are hanging on as they're still hanging on because there's just a ton of them. So Gen X is outnumbered. And now Gen X is also outnumbered by millennials, by us, because we're the children of baby boomers.
Yeah.
There's a lot of us. Mm-hmm. So they're always kind of like these middle children of history, of modern history. And you know, there is a sort of like a big brother syndrome, especially with like older millennials like us, where Gen X, like they're the big brother. So for a while there was this sort of, I think like a psychological underlying need to impress Gen X, and we wanted to be like them, and like because they were nihilistic and cool, they didn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
But anyway, and that kind of like influenced millennial culture. Early millennial culture, in a way, but
yeah, no,
neither here nor there. What were we talking about? We're talking about music,
yeah, and specifically Alanis Morissette, who is again totally emblematic of that era. And you know, I guess the only thing is that if you sit there and listen to her lyrics, she so overwrites. She overwrites everything painfully. Like, she can't just organize a simple, coherent thought. It's got to be this long run-on sentence where it's very, like, well-written if it were, like, on paper, I guess you could say. Or, I mean, it just doesn't translate to a good song. It's not the sort of thing anyone's going to get up on stage and sing karaoke
to. It's prose.
Yeah. Again, everything is just so wordy. Like, she needs to prove it to you that she can write a song. So it makes a lot of the music, even if the production's still pretty solid, you know, it's just, it's not particularly interesting to listen to. That's all I'll say there. Again, a very successful record that sold 4 million. I think this is kind of, this is it for her though. I think this is kind of when Alanis Morissette fades into the ether. A guy named Brendan Benson released an album called La Palco. I only bring this up because I enjoy this record. It's a power pop record. Power pop is some of the easiest, most digestible music you'll ever listen to, and it's very much in the vein of the Beatles. As I understand, he is going to go join the Raconteurs, which is a supergroup of sorts. So, very cool. I like that. And a band called Shishi releases their debut, an album called Knife Play. Shishi is, by the way, spelled X-I-U space X-I-U. They are very abrasive, avant-garde pop music. And it's one of the most difficult lessons or albums you would ever like listen to. Mainly fronted by this guy Jamie Stewart, who works with a couple of other different people that have rotated in and out of the mix. Uses a lot of drum machines, a lot of really unconventional orchestration in his music. Finds a lot of like weird world instruments that probably your average listener can't. Like, we listen to a pop song and it's guitar, bass, drums, piano, we get it. But like, he tries to find instruments that sound different and puts them all together to kind of create these weird pop songs, I guess you could say. And his voice is extremely tortured, the way that he sings. He's got a nice enough voice, but the way that he sings just makes you feel like he's in pain.
Like he's just being punched in the gut?
Yeah, sort of. It's really hard to describe what you actually listen to when you get a Shishi record. And I think it's jarring. It's just really, really jarring to listen to. I listened through completely twice, and even after that I was like, I don't think I want to go back for another round of this. People like this band though. They get great reviews whenever they release an album. This review I think perfectly nails what's going on here. They're like, it's nuts how many amazing melodies you can find in here after the shock wears off. It is just such a blunt, harsh record, but occasionally gives you something that's just absolutely fascinating, that makes you think it's not just there to make you feel uncomfortable. But that's it of all of the, I guess what I was considering mainstream pop music. A couple hip-hop R&B records. Brandy releases Full Moon. She's only 23 years old when she makes this record, and I remember when I was listening to it, I was like, oh, Brandy's old hat. She's long in the tooth with this one, and it's like, she's 23 years old. It's crazy that her debut record she released when she was 14.
That's pretty nuts.
Yeah. That said, she is very much from the old school of 90s R&B. This album sounds fantastic. It's produced by this guy named Rodney Jerkins. We just talked about him because he produced Invincible by Michael Jackson back in, I think it was October of last year. I really like it. It's 70 minutes long. And if you don't like R&B or don't really appreciate R&B production, it's probably just going to be another ho-hum effort. And you're going to be like, why does it have to be 70 minutes long? And it didn't need to be 70 minutes long. It needed to be about 30. There's maybe like...
She should have made two albums.
No. She should have said, Rodney, let's...
No, cut it in half, and like, now we have two albums.
Let's get, like, what we're going to do with the show.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, a British producer named AIM, just A-I-M, released an album called Hinterland. I enjoyed this one. People really reviewed this album very, very highly. When I listen to it, I don't necessarily get it. It's a nice mix of, like, lo-fi hip-hop beats and down-tempo and a little bit of trip-hop in there, and it's got some, you know, some interesting guest appearances, specifically Souls of Mischief, who at this point hadn't made a record in like 7 years. But this group is on there, so cool. It's fun enough, but it's, you know, it's not that great. It's whatever. Nappy Roots released Watermelon Chicken and Grits. They are from Tennessee. It's a collective of hip-hop dudes, and it's their debut. And how do I want to phrase this? Because I'm sure there's some authenticity to what they're doing. They're not from Tennessee, but they sound so much like Outkast. It's crazy. And keep in mind, Outkast.
Are they a bit derivative?
Yeah, Outkast has been swooping up awards and stuff for albums like Stankonia and Atlians and all that. And they're about to have a huge record come out in a few years. But when you listen to this Nappy Roots record, all you can think in your mind is, wow, these guys sound a lot like Outkast. But successful enough, and, you know, it's they got that song Aw Naw on here, which was, like, pretty big hit at the time. I remember hearing it constantly. And maybe this is because we live in the South and it was going to be circulated on all kinds of radio stations. Yeah, I don't know. Really don't know what to say about this one either. I listened to it a bunch, and it's good, but again, you cannot get it out of your mind that it's going to be just another Outkast clone or something. Oh, and it's 74 minutes long. Well, again, no. Guys, stop. Can we just... A 30-minute record is all you need to do. Punk. Busy month for punk. A band called And You Will Know Us by the Trail of the Dead. It's a long title for a band name, but they released an album called Source Tags and Codes. They're from Austin, Texas. This is one of the best reviewed albums of the month. People love this record. It's essentially a post-hardcore record. It's good. I like it a lot. Again, there's a lot of occasionally brilliant melodies in there, and kind of a lot of that harsh post-hardcore stuff, which is fun. A lot of bands say this is a touchstone record for them personally. Like, this was an album that influenced them, so I think it's really cool that they all did that. I go back and listen to it, and the production sounds like shit, honestly. Real talk, production sounds bad. I don't know, like, why they couldn't have made a more hi-fi recording of this. I think it would sound great if they did that, but they didn't, so that's that. People love this record, though. And You Will Know Us by the Trail of the Dead. It's really, really good. McCluskey, album's called Do Dallas, so it's McCluskey Do Dallas. They're from Welsh, or is it Wales? I guess they are Welsh. From Wales. I actually love this record a lot. Steve Albini produced it. So again, this is very immediate and raw and in your face. It's like the same kind of weird and bizarro humor you might get from something like South Park with the way they write songs. Super fun record. Love it. Got a lot of weird hooks in it and just all over the place. It's really just a manic record. A lot of fun to listen to. I mean, literally the first track is called like Lightsaber Cocksucking Blues. Just
perfect.
Everything about it feels mad, like it was mad-libbed. So delightful. Thrice releases Illusion of Safety. Thrice is a really big band, also in the post-hardcore scene. The thing that makes Thrice different from someone like, I don't know, like Thursday, for example, or Brand New, is that these guys incorporate a lot of, like, actual metal, like thrash metal and stuff, into their sound. Very good record. We had just talked about Rise Against Unraveling. If you listened to that and you liked it, and you should have liked that, you will like this. So that's that. Good. Yes. Desperacitos, I think this is a Spanish word, but Desperacitos releases their debut record. It is a guy named Connor Oberst. Connor Oberst of Bright Eyes fame and a bunch of other bands. His other album, Bright Eyes, is really more like folk music, I guess you could say. This is him kind of doing an emo album. And it's great. It's really great. I love this record a lot. It's called Read Music, Speak Spanish. How should I describe this one? Like, it's... He has a very, like, soft and gentle voice. So to hear him do this kind of, like, emo, not screaming, but just kind of, like, yelling, like, going for it, playing, like, actual rock music and not the usual folk stuff, works so well for him and for this sound. It's nice to hear him sing with some teeth, you know? It's got kind of a Weezer vibe to it, of all things, which is strange because Weezer, I think, is probably the most commercial band ever. Like, if there was a band I wanted to put a car commercial to, it would be those guys. And this one is exclusively about anti-consumerism and anti-capitalism. It's really interesting because a lot of the emo music too is also about relationships and stuff, a lot of just drama, and he writes an album that really doesn't have shit to do with like relationship drama, but exclusively to do with corporate America, like the problems with corporate America taking over small towns, specifically Nebraska, which is where he's from. Love this record though. I'm getting off track. It's just a good record. Listen to it. Blood Brothers released March on Electric Children. It's their second album. They're from Seattle. Screamo outfit. They're screamo. They're like post-punk mixed with screamo. Again, if Shishi wasn't jarring enough, people really should listen to these two guys. It's absolutely fantastic. It's not two guys. It's a full band and two dudes that are just like screaming their lungs out back and forth over some just delightfully catchy post-punk. It's hard to describe, but they will make a very good album after this called Burn Piano Island Burn, which is one of my all-time favorite records. The Lawrence Arms, you can call them Larry Arms if you want,
I do.
The Larry Arms are, they released this album called Apathy and Exhaustion. This is another Chicago three-piece pop-punk band.
It's going to be a new DLC for the Arms game.
Yeah.
New character.
Kind of 7 years later, we'll
do DLC, two DLC. Here's Larry Arms.
Larry Arms. So the Lawrence Arms.
It's Lawrence Fishburne in the Event Horizon chair. Those two big arms that come from the side.
Oh my gosh, the charges chair just floats around?
Yeah.
Oh my god, I'm on board. We should make games.
All we need to do is get the rights to the
image of Lawrence Fishburne.
Larry Fishburne, yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
What do you think they mean by Lawrence Arms, though?
Lawrence Arms?
Yeah. It's actually pretty mundane. It's apparently the apartment complex they lived at in Chicago. Okay.
Hmm.
Yeah. Right. Lawrence Arms. I don't know. But
I was thinking of the Senate Amendment, the Second Amendment. Everybody has the right to hang bear arms above their fireplace.
Everyone's got the right to Larry Arms. Any rate.
I'm so sad.
Moving on. It's a three-piece from Chicago. They make pop punk, and, you know, it's not Alkaline Trio, but... Mm. I won't go any further into it other than to say I like this band. This is not their best record, and their future records will be way better, but Apathy and Exhaustion is still really, really good. It's got Boatless Booze Cruise on it, which is like a closer for these guys. I've seen them play like 3 or 4 times. They always close with that track. It's great for them. Boards of Canada, which is like the premier... Oh, we moved on to electronic and ambient now, but Boards of Canada, they released a recent album called Geogatti. They are...
That's a good name.
Yeah,
Geogatti.
G E O G A D D I.
It sounds like a piece I'll put on my computer. Like, yeah, I gotta get a new Geogatti.
Or like a dessert at a Greek restaurant. Of the baklava and the Geogatti.
Do you have a Geogatti?
We do have Geogatti.
I hear it's great here.
Yeah. But Scottish duo. They're like probably the biggest name in IDM. So, not my personal favorite in the world of IDM, but they're super duper popular in that world. 23 tracks over 66 minutes and 6 seconds. That's deliberate that it's 66 minutes and 6 seconds. Mm.
They were at like 64 minutes, like, we can get there.
We just got ripped for a little bit, just, yeah.
It's an album that, if you listen to it too, it doesn't sound demonic, but buried in the back of it is a lot of...
It's what the demons want you to think.
Yeah, you know how there was like, you spin a record backwards and it's like satanic or whatever, and it's not like that. It's not so silly and stupid as that. But there is just a lot of... There is this kind of undercurrent of evil that runs through what is ostensibly just a bunch of beautiful, soothing tracks of IDM, down-tempo electronic music.
I think I made this joke before, but I would like to see a record that's just like all about the devil, but you play it backwards and it's just Bible verses.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Or like some gospel music.
Yeah, I think that'd be really funny.
Yeah.
Sit tight, Wes. I actually have a band that you might want to hear.
Okay. If it's demonic music, I don't want to actually listen to that.
Okay. So Boards of Canada. This is actually a really, really big record. A big record for the month. I like it a lot, but again, I think there's way better music in the IDM scene than Boards of Canada. But hey, it's there. People like it. Tommy February 6 is an artist from Japan. It is a woman, in fact. She releases her self-titled album. Her name's Tomoko Kawase. I guess she goes by Tommy. Her name's Tomoko. And February 6th is her birthday. So that's why how she landed that moniker.
She wanted everyone to know.
I love this record. It's really, really fun. It is sort of like 90s dance music. Like 90s dance music mixed with what we now call PC music. Just really in-your-face immediate pop tracks. Dance pop tracks. Absolutely love it. Really, really fun record. There's a song on here called Every Day at the Bus Stop. All the songs are so like delightfully sung in broken English. Half the tracks are in Japanese and half of the tracks are in English. And some of them just go back and forth line by line. I think she might actually be saying back and forth the same sentence just in both languages so everybody can enjoy the song. So again, super over the top, really bright, shiny pop music. Very, very good. I like it a lot. And lastly, for the electronic music, you got Yagya, Yagya. Rhythm of Snow, the debut record, ambient techno composer. I love the shit out of this. I love ambient techno in general, and he is one of the best. Rhythm of Snow fucking slays. If you want some really beautiful chill out music, and you want to listen to techno, but you don't want that aggressive throbbing bass line in your face all the time, like, this is really the way to go. It's so soothing. It's very... very chill. I mean, it's called Rhythm of Snow. As you can imagine, these sound like very cold, frigid soundscapes, but absolutely beautiful to listen to. I would also recommend. We just talked about Mono Lake's Gravity, and Biosphere just released an album prior to that called Substrata. So this was a really good era for people starting to make ambient techno. And then we get into metal. Just 25. A few more. What's up?
25.
I'm at 25 minutes.
Yep.
I'm doing okay then. So, Wes, for you, Under Oath, Changing of the Times. Ever heard of Under Oath?
I've heard the name.
It is a Christian metalcore band.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, and they are also based out of Tampa, so you don't have to go far to find them. I've seen this band.
So I have to go to Tampa to listen to these people? That seems a little extreme.
Yeah. As I recall, they were originally from Ocala, too. I believe they were from Ocala, but moved to Tampa. Believe it or not, this is the second band we're going to talk about that moved to Tampa. But at any rate,
running from the law.
Yeah, it's a good place to hide out. You go to Ybor City and they'll never find you.
Because they'll never look.
Nope. So yeah, this is a really, really influential band. And it is a faith band too, which is what's so crazy. Because if you listen to it, it is, again, really fucking harsh. This is, again, it's metalcore with a lot of screamo influence. And the singer would resemble the vocal stylings of black metal artists too. Real fucking harsh. But I don't know, it manages to still be faith music. And it's also important to note that, like, there has not been a successful faith band like prior to these guys and POD coming out. Like, it had been, god, and again, we're talking about 2002. You'd have to go back in time about 20 years to find Stryper, a hair metal band. They're like the last band that broke through with Christian rock music. It's just sort of a dead scene, really. Aside from people that are exclusively consuming Christian music.
Now, you're thinking of, like, what about bands like Switchfoot and things like that? I mean,
yeah. I mean, but Switchfoot themselves were nowhere near as big as Under Oath is going to be.
Huh.
Yeah. Like, and again, there are specific scenes for faith music, but nobody's really trying to bring anything to the metal scene for this. So, very cool that they're out there. Also, it's the last album with this guy, Dallas Taylor. He's going to leave the band. He'll get replaced by Enemy Spencer Chamberlain, who's a better vocalist, in my opinion. And they're going to make some way better albums down the road. But this one, it's a banger. This one's a really good record. I actually like this one a lot. Moving on. And now I told you guys to listen to. Did you listen to Immortal Sons of Northern Darkness?
I did.
You actually listened to it. What'd you think about it? What's your opinion?
Oh, it's intense.
Yeah.
Intense. Yeah, it's some harsh vocals. I think the thing that stood out to me the most...
Big camping pants.
All the tracks just have like these like really fast, steady, like machine gun drums.
Okay,
like, he is really banging those drums.
Yeah, it's a lot of double bass. You definitely hear a lot of that high BPM double bass going off all the time. That is emblematic of black metal. They do that a lot. And specifically, this was from Bergen, Norway. We were just talking about that band Tak last month, that they released a record from Bergen, Norway, and you got another group here. Yeah, so that really oppressive double bass that you're getting the whole time on top of those really gross vocals. And then just the riffs are fantastic. Like, there's a lot of just melodic, really interesting guitar work all over the place. I love this record. Did you by any chance sit down with any of the lyrics?
No.
It is over-the-top fantasy metal shit. It is ridiculous. It's so, so funny. Like,
about, like, dragons and shit?
Oh, they're kind of like you're riding into battle. Like, they think of themselves as, like, again, the sons of Northern Darkness. Like, they're the invading Vikings and shit. Okay. One of the tracks on here is specifically about, which one is it? Mountains of Madness. One of the tracks on here is basically a telling of the events of Mountains of Madness by H.P. Lovecraft. Again, it sounds so abrasive at first, and then you realize they're just like, they're the biggest dorks. These guys are such like fantasy dorks. I love this record. I think it's really, really fun, and people should go listen to it. Immortal Sons of Northern Darkness. A couple more albums here. Cannibal Corpse, released Gore Obsessed. Have you guys ever heard of Cannibal Corpse?
No.
Just by reputation, never heard of them. They managed to be one of the biggest bands in death metal. Oh, by the way, they are originally from Buffalo, and they moved to Tampa as well. So
Buffalo is kind of the Tampa of New York,
I guess. So, you know, them and Under Oath are over there, I'm sure, at the titty bars, slinging money around.
Playing D&D with Wes. Yes.
I mean, Under Oath is there trying to convert the women to Christianity, though.
Of course.
That's the key difference between what their efforts are. Anyway, yeah.
But, not judgmentally, so. They're not, like, telling their sinners for...
Oh, they're still getting their lap dances, yeah. Yeah, but they're just letting them know about it while they're liking.
Christ loves you more than I love this lap dance, you know.
Exactly.
So, yeah. But then this lap dance isn't good. I mean,
this is great. You know what else is great? Forgiveness.
Moving on. Cannibal Corpse. They released their eighth record as a band, which is kind of crazy to think that this is their eighth album already. They are one of the staples of death metal. They're kind of lightning rods for controversy because they've always been one of the more, like, overtly, like, violent groups. Like, they're the ones that all of the conservative moms are worried about their kids listening to. But their lyrics are just so fucking silly. It's hard to, like, again, they're gross. They're really gross. All their album covers are, like, horrifying. They're just really, really nasty and violent in the way that, like, a Saw film is nasty and violent. It's just what they do. But that said, in the world of death metal, this band is kind of boring, honestly. They make the same albums over and over and over again, and they all sound the same, and all the lyrics are gross as fuck, and their riffs are really uninspired. And, I mean, it's good for what it is. Like, if you want grisly, nasty, violent death metal, these guys are the name of the game. They're one of the biggest at it. But in the same way that I was gushing last month about Bolt Thrower, like, Bolt Thrower is a fascinating band that's constantly doing interesting stuff. You know, Cannibal Corpse just never bothered to do anything different. They just kind of make the same albums over and over and over again. So, fun enough for what it is, but I'm not crazy about it. From Poland, we have the band Decapitated. They released Nihility?
Cannibal Corpse. Decapitated.
Get this, guys. I don't even remember. We talked about Cannibal Corpse. Or, sorry, we already talked about Decapitated once.
Oh, did we?
Yeah, we talked about them because they released an album about 18 months ago. We've been at this for so long now. We're revisiting albums we've already talked about. They had their debut. I didn't even realize this when we were talking about it, but they had this debut album called Winds of Creation. I love these guys, by the way. This is actually really, like, cutting edge fun death metal, like, clever and doing interesting things. They were, like, the youngest member of the band was 15 years old when they recorded Winds of Creation. The average age in the band was like 18. These guys were so fucking young, and here they are already with their second album, like, a year and a half later, 2 years older. The production is incredible on this record. It sounds so good. Like, when we were listening to that Immortal record, you got to keep in mind that drummer's probably got 12, 13 years of experience in bands drumming. Like, that's why he's able to do that shit. Like, the drummer for Decapitated is, like, 18, and he's shredding the kit. He sounds amazing. Constantly doing all these interesting flourishes and coming up with ways to spice up the formula of what a band like Cannibal Corpse struggles to do. You know, I just really love this record. Like, there's tons of amazing riffs. Also, it's a three-piece as well, which makes it really nice and easy to kind of compartmentalize. You got a bass, guitar, drums, that's it. So you're not worried about a rhythm guitarist and then some other guy trying to do lead guitar.
Mm.
It's right there for you. It's really easy to digest, and it's so technical and just really doesn't skimp on the brutality of death metal, but just gives you a lot of really interesting ear candy. Last album from Coral Gables, Florida. You guys know where that is?
Oh, yes.
Poison the Well. Poison the Well releases Tear from the Red. And it's a metalcore album. Really good. Just tons and tons of breakdowns. Just so breakdown heavy. It is just lots of, like, stuff to get a circle pick going. Absolutely loved it. It's a really fun record. And that's it. That's all the music.
Cool. Wes, you got any albums?
Tons of them. Yeah, just.
Movies? Should we move on?
Let's do it.
All right.
Let's do it.
We got a bunch of movies to get through here. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I think you might have one that's not on my list.
I've got, let me do my piece count here real quick. I have 10 as well.
Cool. Well, let's start off with a movie called Slackers. Actually, I don't have any information pulled up, so I don't know who directed or this movie. The only person I don't recognize...
know, why did you even watch this? I skimmed through the list and just deemed it not noteworthy. It was having seen this movie.
I vaguely remember this.
It was available to watch for free on Amazon Prime. They're like, well, research time. it's not good. It's not worth watching. It was not even available in HD. I was watching this movie in standard definition.
Oh my god.
Yeah. The only recognizable, I mean, it's got like the guy from Pete and Pete. But then it's also got...
That's the only reason why I watched it back in the day, too, as a super fan of the TV show Adventures of Pete and Pete, is that I wanted to see what Big Pete's acting career would become, and it sadly is this.
Oh. It's got Jason Segel, who probably recognized from other comedies, with ones like Judd Apatow or like How I Met Your Mother, so the new Muppet movie. So he's gone on to do better things than Slackers. I could not tell you... Oh, it's also got Jason Schwartzman. He's like the villain... this creep who's stalking this girl. I could not tell you like what it is that pushes the plot forward in this movie. The basic setup is these three friends are cheating their way through college through like these complex schemes that they're doing in order to obtain answers to tests before the exam. But they get found out by Jason Schwartzman, who then blackmails them into luring this female classmate of theirs into trying to get her to date Jason Schwartzman, who's got this creepy shrine built to her in her closet. Like he's every cliche trope of what you think of as a creepy stalker. Like he is. He's short. He's got like a unibrow. He's got pictures in his closet. He collects her hair.
Wait, that's not a good thing to do?
No, you shouldn't.
That's flattering.
Wes, if you're doing that, you should stop. Because you don't ever want to get found out.
I mean, it's your stuff, but...
You know. All right, it's fine then.
with your permission. Can I continue to stalk you?
it's not stalking if I know you're doing it and I enjoy it. But our male lead ends up falling for the girl as well. And like... I think they're trying to like set it up like where he's like playing both sides. He's like trying to date her as well as trying to convince Jason Schwartzman that like, no, I'm trying to convince her to date you this whole time too. And like his two buddies kind of disappear from the movie. Eventually, like he gets found out that he's playing both sides. So then the girl starts hanging out with the creepy stalker guy as well, even though she knows he's a creep. This movie did not make a ton of sense, nor was it particularly funny or fun in any way. Like sometimes like dumb college movies, like things like Van Wilder, like they're not particularly good movies, but there's at least something to enjoy because you got a likable leading man who's going to be quippy. You don't have any of that in this movie. It's trash.
Yeah. It's terrible. I feel like I blocked out most of what it was when I saw it back probably around, I don't know, 2005 or 6. Yeah. Again, there's actually a lot of really good people in the cast here. Again, like you said, Jason Schwartzman, Devin Sawa, Jason Segel, our boy Mike Marona, who is Big Pete. Jamie King is in it. That's really cool. Jim Rash of Community.
He's in it.
Oh.
It's a good cast. It's just, I remember this movie just being, like, so unfunny.
Mm.
So unfunny. Nothing interesting at all happening in it.
Like, and there were points, like, long stretches where it didn't even seem like they were trying to attempt to tell a joke. It was more just like a love story where nothing was really at stake. There was no conflict between the two characters who are falling for each other.
Not that he is the end-all be-all of critics, but Roger Ebert gave it 0 out of 4 stars.
We're on the same page on that one. You want
to tell me? What do you think it cost to make the movie like that?
Oof.
Ooh.
Mm.
I don't know.
I think it's got to be real low. I'm going to go...
14.
I'm going to go lower. I'll go 10.
14.
Oh! Fuck! Oh,
I know nothing about this movie.
Nailed it.
Then tell me how much it made.
Oh, I'm going to go with 4.
I don't think it made its money back either. I'm going to stick with 10. I'll go with 10 again.
6.4. So
you're close.
I'm pretty close.
It lost money, but you're pretty close. Yeah,
I'm pretty close.
All right. Yeah, there's like the Cruise family went and saw the movie. No one else.
That made up for 6.5 mil.
Yeah. Depends on how many people were working on the movie, I suppose. Anyway, why don't you tag in with them? What you got?
Sure. So I've got a movie called Big Fat Liar. You heard of this one?
That's the Frankie Muniz one.
Yeah, Frankie Muniz and Amanda Bynes.
Paul Giamatti?
I believe so, yeah. It's basically
kind of like
a
villain
allegory for The Boy Who Cried Wolf.
Oh my God. Okay, sure.
Your dog is dying?
You okay, sure.
All right.
Now he like looks right at me like, why'd you stop petting me?
You good, buddy? You lost your shit right there. Holy cow.
Any rate. Okay, so Frankie Muniz and Amanda Bynes are in this vehicle. Yeah, I guess the premise is like he's a compulsive liar who had written a script that gets it stolen by some movie exec, and then everyone doesn't believe him or something. I don't know. I didn't watch this movie. I don't really care to watch this movie. It looks stupid. It's just interesting that, you know, at this point, I'm sure Frankie Muniz and Amanda Bynes were much bigger deals than they are now. Amanda Bynes struggled with drug addiction and just mental instability. I think she's on a better path now, but not great for her. And Frankie Muniz is now a professional race car driver.
He sure is.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Just recently he retired, declared he retired from acting. Might not have been entirely voluntary, but yeah, he races NASCAR. He's a NASCAR driver professionally now.
Mm-hmm.
Good for him.
It's not like he just decided to do this. I remember when he was very, very young too. Like he loved racing, so this was obviously a.
He was in that one movie where he was
Buddy Holly. In Walk Hard, he played Buddy Holly.
I'm
trying to throw you a lifeline here.
It was in a movie where he was a kid who couldn't walk but wanted to do the derby, the racing derbies.
I don't know this.
Yeah, he was very young.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, he was driving.
It'd be weird if it's not, and I got this out of nowhere.
Yeah. Are you thinking of Billy Elliot with Tom Holland?
See, now I gotta freaking Google this.
You're not thinking of Billy Elliot. He'd been racing race cars for a while. It's not like he just decided, I'm gonna be a race car driver. It had been a more than a hobby for him for a while now.
That's one of the Disney Channel movies.
There's actually a weird bit, like, I remember this because I was like, what a bizarre moment to have this happen, but he was at the race where Dale Earnhardt died.
Oh, shit.
Oh.
And he was being filmed when the crash happened.
Mm.
So, just weird. Because he was being interviewed for some other purpose, and that just occurred in the background. Sean Levy directed this movie, guys. Sean Levy would probably, if you saw him in public, don't bring up the fact that he directed Big Fat Liar. You'd probably bring up the fact that he's a director of Deadpool, Night at the Museum series, he did Free Guy. So, you know.
I'm definitely going to lead with Big Fat Liar.
Lead with Big Fat Liar.
When we meet.
So what do you think this movie cost to make?
It's got to be more than Slackers. So, what was Slackers?
14?
14 million. Because Wes was right on the money. I'll go, I don't even know, like, what sort of effects or anything in there is. You got 20 million. I'll go 20.
15.
15?
Yeah.
It's 15.
Oh, are you shit. Wes.
Are you serious?
He's a soothsayer.
Oh, first New Zealand and now this. This is amazing.
Wes, give me some water numbers if you could real quick. Oh, my gosh.
All right. By the way, the movie I was thinking of is fucking Miracle in Lane 2. Based on a true story, a 13-year-old boy who uses a wheelchair is determined to win a trophy like his athletic older brother.
Wow.
Well, I don't know that movie.
It's an old ass Disney Channel movie.
Did it have Frank Muniz in it?
Yeah. He was the kid.
Oh, wow. I think this movie made some money.
What do you think it did?
I'll go, it definitely made its money back. I'll go 40 million. 4-0.
What do you think?
30.
53.
Okay. Ooh.
Did pretty good. All things considered. Yeah. Did pretty good. Also, this is a movie that will get raked by critics, as virtually every movie we will talk about from here on out will be raked by critics.
Yeah, is there a movie that had a positive?
I did.
Like, Rotten Tomatoes rating?
I thought it would be insulting to talk about Monsoon Wedding with really no understanding of it, other than it's an Indian film, but that got like 95%. Hmm. I should have watched that movie.
Yes.
Didn't want to watch it.
the one movie that probably was worth a watch.
Yeah, Monsoon Wedding was a huge film. I don't think you're supposed to call it a Bollywood film. I think it's just a popular Indian film.
Hmm.
It's not like Bollywood movies, but that was the only really well reviewed movie of the month, and it got again like high 90s reviews by everybody loved it. But yeah, everything else I want to talk about is trash.
Cool.
You want to do the next one, or should I just go with my
list? Next one on the list? I had Collateral Damage. I didn't watch it.
That was
the Schwarzenegger one.
Yeah, actually, I watched this one. I guess we should start with the fact that it's directed by this guy, Andrew Davis, who has made a ton of really good movies, actually. He did, like, The Fugitive and Under Siege. Think of what you know about Steven Seagal. Under Siege is a really good action movie. He did one called Code of Silence, this really old-school, grisly Chuck Norris film from the 80s, the mid-80s. He did, like, Chain Reaction, which, you know, it's a fun enough movie. But then he makes this. It's a really kind of generic, low-effort action movie. Like, Schwarzenegger doesn't really even have the gravitas to carry something this average. Like, he's great when he's doing either total badass, like the fucking Terminator, or when he's playing way off character and doing something like a Jingle All the Way or...
Tremendous
film. You know, even like Last Action Hero, he gets to have some fun. And this movie, he's being too serious. He's just not having any fun. He's basically, the premise is that he's a firefighter whose family is killed as a result of quote-unquote collateral damage by Colombian drug lords. So he's got to go exact revenge, basically.
Yeah. What a tortured premise.
It is. It's very tortured. It's very, very stupid. And yeah, he goes and does this whole thing. I'm not getting into the plot. Other than to say that it is a low-effort attempt to navigate the viewer from below average action set piece to action set piece.
Hmm.
And it Which ends.
In turn, he actually causes a lot of collateral damage throughout the movie.
Stop.
If you're
We're better than this.
Are we, though?
If you're part of the Colombian cartel, yes, he did. He sure fucks up some cartel types. No, but yeah. Like, and there's a twist at the end that you can see coming from a mile away. It's very obvious that someone is not being truthful about who they are, and that ends, of course, being part of the whole thing. It does have a really good cast, though. There's some other big names. John Turturro and Leguizamo.
Shit, you got them both.
Stealing scenes, both of them. Like, they know this movie's bad, but at least they're bringing it. They're trying. And it shows. They're both very, very good in this movie. In spite of the fact that they got nothing to work with, really. So I would say skip it. It's bad. Andrew Davis, again, great director. Fucking Schwarzenegger, one of the best, like, action actors ever. Like... These two should have made something way better than this. Mm. And not even, like, it's just so average and generic. It's not even fun. It's not even fun. So, that's whatever. What do you think it cost?
It's an action movie with Schwarzenegger. I'm going to go, I'll go $60 million. Go a little bit high on this one.
Oof. I don't know how much costs to make a movie. 45.
Okay, 85.
Oh, very expensive. That's an expensive movie.
Yeah. And big action set pieces and shit. What do you think it cost?
I think it's Schwarzenegger, so it probably brought in an audience. I'll go even $100 million.
$150 million.
A mere $75 million.
Ooh.
Yeah, this is kind of in a time where Schwarzenegger is going to not be the draw he used to be. So he's got a bunch of very average films that are going to come out over the next few years.
Hmm. And that'll be The Governor.
And that'll be The Governor.
Spoilers, people listening in 2002.
What?
California will elect Arnold Schwarzenegger as the governor. God, what right. a time to be alive.
What's your next movie?
Is he still governor?
No.
No.
Rollerball.
Yes.
You guys are going to keep the stinkers going.
Oh, boy.
This movie, starring the one guy who's like the least, who's got the least funny lines in the American Pie series.
Oh, yeah, that dude. What's his name?
I don't even remember the guy's name. Also got... oh, my goodness. Who's his buddy in the movie? Anyway, neither here nor there. I don't have the cast list in front of me.
Chris Klein.
Chris Klein is the guy.
Our boy LL's in it.
Yeah, LL Cool J.
Jean Reno. Rebecca Romijn.
And they're all absolutely wasted.
Yeah. So, Naveen Andrews. Yeah, I mean, again, it's not a bad cast. It's a pretty good cast.
So, the
I would start with who directed this. Fucking John McTiernan.
Hmm.
The guy that made Predator and Die Hard.
Yep.
Like this is action film royalty right here making this movie.
And yeah, this is what they come up with. And like the action scenes in this movie are are a bunch of outside of like a couple of chase scenes, the action scenes are a bunch of people playing this totally inscrutable game of rollerball, which is like roller derby, except like there's a motorcycle involved for some reason, and they have to put a ball. It's like roller derby basketball with motorcycles, and they kind of there's this obnoxious announcer who tries to set up the rules of this game, who I think also was like an announcer for like the WWE, but. The it's totally inscrutable, and
Paul Heyman, yeah,
and at some point in this movie, like early on, he pretty much like says as he's trying to explain, he's like, you know what, don't even worry about it, let's just watch this. Like even you don't know the thing that you are trying to show us, John McTiernan. the plot. Like,
I won't blame John McTiernan for this movie.
I think that's probably fair.
But
there are other people involved in the making of this movie. It wasn't all his fault.
When we're done talking about what this thing is actually about, we'll get to McTiernan's narrative in this, which is far more fascinating than the movie itself.
So let's not spend too much time in the actual movie. The things that happen in between these rollerball matches are thoroughly uninteresting. There's a love story. They're trying to escape Russia for some reason. Like, the sport is played exclusively in Russia. LL Cool J somehow convinces our lead character to quit being like this. Like, he's like a guy who does, like, the luge, you know, that Olympic sport where people just lay down flat as a board on a road and zip down a downhill area.
Yeah, he's doing that at the beginning. That transfers over perfectly.
And then he's like, hey, you like doing this freelance luging, why not come play rollerball? And then he does, and they try to escape, and LL Cool J gets into some hot water, and then Jean Reno blackmails John Klein? Chris Klein.
Yeah.
Into having to stay and play on the rollerball team, but they're trying to play each other. And I couldn't even tell you how this... It was unbelievably uninteresting.
Yeah. So, so this is a film that had a very troubled production. For starters, John McTiernan, this is not the film he wanted to make in the first place. He had envisioned this as a hard R with a lot of sex and violence film, and they totally took it away from him and made him make it PG-13. This was supposed to be... I'm guessing that this was supposed to be somewhere between Running Man and Gladiator is what this guy wanted to do. Something that is just brutal. And that would be fitting with who John McTiernan is as a director. I think that, yeah, they cleaned this up for PG audiences, and the story, I'm sure, is absolute trash, because why does anyone want to see that in the first place? No one's going to a movie like this for a story. And also, this is the funniest part about, not funny, not funny for him, it sucks for him, but he actually went...
Peculiar, funny as in peculiar.
He went to prison because of this movie.
Go on.
All right.
He believed that there was a, conspiracy against him from the producer of the film. So he hired a private investigator who wiretapped him to listen into his phone calls. It was discovered that he had wiretapped him, which is a felony, and was sentenced to 2 years in prison.
Huh.
Because of this movie. That's how bad this was for his career. Most people make a bad movie and then move on with their lives.
Right.
He made a movie so bad he had to go to jail. And I really do feel bad for him, because, like, he's a very smart man. I've known about this event in his life, never to the extent of which I researched it. Just that he was engaged in some kind of wiretapping thing that got him in trouble. I knew about that. But I love this guy. I watched there was like a hour and a half long documentary about the director. And they don't talk about this at all. They don't talk about any of the shit about him getting arrested, even though it was made after the fact. They kind of just talk about why he's such an important action director and what he did that was different than a lot of other directors, and why he's super influential, and why Spielberg and James Cameron picked up a lot of stuff from him, and why action movies are the way they are now because of McTiernan. He's very, very important as a director, and has the films to showcase it, too. Like, it's not like he's nobody. It's just really sad, because this is basically the last movie he's going to make. He just now, being the past 3 or 4 years here in 2023, has started started directing television again. So that's how long it's taken for him to sort of scrub his record. And it's only because of...
He clearly, like, suffered some sort of, like, mental trauma from...
Yeah.
Having to be involved in this, as should, I probably everybody did, from having to be involved in this train wreck.
Yeah, this movie, oh my god. I'm sure he'd give anything to have not made this piece of shit.
Yeah, it's not particularly interesting or novel in terms of, like, a vision of the future. It's not a particularly interesting or novel sport that you're supposed to be watching. And the things that happen in between, like this struggle of this guy trying to escape this thing that he got involved in, probably not unlike John McTiernan, it is not particularly interesting either. I think the movie about John McTiernan losing it over making this movie would be better.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, it is based off of another movie. It's based off of a movie that came out in the 70s. Again, I've also never seen this movie either, so I don't know how this holds up. I can't imagine the original is any worse. So I guess we're gonna watch one, watch that one, but you're probably better off watching neither of them.
Right.
Budget?
Ooh, I think this movie's probably expensive. God, what was Collateral Damage again? That was 85, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that's also like Arnold and stuff.
Yeah, I don't think it could be as expensive as Collateral Damage.
I'm gonna go with 45, which is what was my guess for the other one.
I'm gonna go higher. I'll go 55.
70.
Mm.
Yeah.
What do you think it made?
If there's any justice, $2. I don't think this... So the budget was 75. I don't think it made its money back.
I'm going to go 50.
I'm going to go lower. I'll go 40.
26. This is a pretty big bomb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. I think those producers were out to get him. I'm on his side.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh. So, next one I have is Crossroads.
Yep. That's the next one on my list, too. I did not watch it.
Yeah. I think we talked about this a bunch because we talked about Oops, I Did It Again, an album that Britney Spears had released, and I talked a bit about her touring schedule and her making this film, and I was like, for basically this 3-year period, or maybe 2.5 years, she was maybe the single busiest person in the world.
Yeah.
And it probably had a lot to do with her breakdown.
Yeah, and certainly for you know, the good part, well, probably more than half a decade, probably the most famous person in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. So, this was a film that she had made, as I understand, in between a previous tour. She was literally shooting this movie while on tour. Kind of insane that she did this.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's as a vehicle meant to capitalize on the success of Britney Spears. Like that video game State of Emergency that was just trying to capitalize on Grand Theft Auto. I think this movie is really just like, how famous is Britney Spears? Can she make money if we just put her in a thing and put it on its screen?
Better or worse than Coyote Ugly?
I didn't even watch it. I did watch Glitter, and people say Glitter is like the worst movie ever, and Glitter is on par with Coyote Ugly. Nobody's like, Coyote Ugly is the worst movie ever, but they're like, Glitter is trash. It's like, no, it's fine. They're both average. They're fine. Anyway, and Tamara Davis directed this. Tamara Davis is the director of Half Baked.
Okay.
But yeah, I've seen parts of this movie. It is not a Half Baked style comedy. It is very much just like a earnest Britney Spears. She's got a heart of gold, by the way. Britney Spears is every bit the doe-eyed mark she seems like she would be. She seems like she's a very genuine and nice person, and it's a shame that she all of America
horribly exploited her.
Yes. So what do you think this cost to make? What's the budgets?
I don't think it could have been much.
I came to guess. I know zero about this. Like all the other
ones. You're gonna abstain?
I'm gonna abstain this one because I couldn't even.
I'll go 20 million.
12.
Okay, good.
I'll lead up. I was gonna say 12.
Slackers, Slackers cost more than this movie.
My goodness, and this movie had Britney Spears.
How much do you think it made?
This movie fucking banked. It made 10 times its money back. 120 million.
70.
61.
There you go.
I was going to say 12.
It was so successful. I mean, that's a good return on investment, but yeah.
Five times return.
I imagine that even Britney Spears fans probably walked out of that one like, eh. All right. Next I have on my list is John Q.
Okay, I got John Q. Did you have anything about Hearts War?
Oh, no, I don't.
We're going to skip that one. I didn't watch it either.
Okay.
John Q, Denzel Washington.
Right.
Who do you have as a director? I don't know who directed that one.
Nick Cassavetes. He's more of an actor. You'd probably recognize him more for his acting than he did as a director, but he is famous for directing The Notebook.
Oh, that's right.
So he has a couple of huge hits under his belt, but for the most part, if you just saw the guy, you'd be like, oh, he's been in a million things.
Hmm.
Typically plays like a bad guy. He plays like the sort of bad guy, corrupt cop kind of guy.
So I think like the premise of John Q probably works a bit better if they had made this movie 20 years later. Because if I remember correctly,
I think people are probably now very much more upset about.
I haven't. I haven't watched this movie. It's been several years, probably a couple decades since I saw this movie. But the general premise, as far as I remember, is Denzel Washington is this guy who's getting his hours cut at his job. So he's losing his things like his health benefits. He's not making as much money because in this country we have healthcare that's tied to employment, and his child becomes ill, needs, I think it's like a heart transplant. He needs like some sort of organ transplant, but he does not have the insurance or the money to actually get it done because healthcare is exorbitantly expensive in this country. So he ends up trying to sell everything he owns, still doesn't have it enough. So he basically, like a Dog Day Afternoon style, holds a hospital hostage. And it turns it, I can't remember how much of the movie it is, but I think it's a substantial amount where he's actually like in the hospital. With a negotiator. I can't even remember who else was in this movie. But
James Woods, Ray Liotta, and Haish. So I'm guessing James Woods and Ray Liotta. Pick one. One's probably the doctor and the other's probably the negotiator.
Right, right. But then
probably swapped roles halfway through the movie.
Nobody noticed. So, in the end, I do disagree. Remember the end of this movie, he ends up like giving up his own heart for his jaw to have transplanted. So he fucking dies.
Nope.
So now, they get with the last minute. There's the motorcycle crash.
Yeah, that they show like the very beginning of the movie. There's some kind of car crash, and the last minute there's even a shot where he's like rushing the kid into the hospital and John or Denzel's all got like a mask on and he sneaks into the surgery or whatever, which he doesn't need to fucking be there. And then like it ends with his son saying goodbye to him after the court hearing that sentenced him to jail because, you know, he fucking...
Yeah, held a hospital hostage. Yeah.
And, you know, he says goodbye to him and puts his arms up because it was like that. It's like, we're strong or whatever, that they have some kind of inside thing with them. And that's the end of the movie.
Why are we talking about this movie? Wes over here knows.
I haven't seen this movie in probably 10 years, and I still just... Yeah.
It's this very, like, dystopian take on a healthcare system that in 2002, probably we didn't realize how broken it was.
I think the messaging is pretty blunt and what it's trying to say about the healthcare system, and they're right.
Right.
Our healthcare system is a racket.
But nobody was shouting it in 2002 as loudly as people shout about it now. Mm-hmm. So this movie kind of had a bit of a novel take that other movies weren't addressing. This social condition of having for-profit healthcare and healthcare that's tied to employment. What happens if employment goes away? People still get sick if they don't have jobs.
Yeah. I mean, it's like if you break an arm, you can go in there and they'll fix your arm. But if you need a heart transplant, what are you going to do? Like, they'll bill you forever for a broken arm, but they'll never perform a surgery like that.
Right.
What if you need scheduled chemotherapy treatments? That does not happen to someone that doesn't have insurance.
Right. They're just like, fine, go ahead and die.
Yeah. It's a message worth sending out there, but it seems like it's a pretty blunt delivery of it, and it's a bit a torture to set up.
Bit on the nose.
Yeah. Again, another movie that got panned by critics. I mean, again, everything. If we haven't said it, everything here is like a sub 30% on Rotten Tomatoes, and that's pretty much what the consensus was: is that it's a ham-fisted, blunt delivery of this message. And aside from Denzel's great performance, it's just not there. Budget?
Oh man, I don't know. What do you think, Wes? You go first this time.
I don't know. 72.
I'm gonna go way lower.
It's Denzel, their hospital, and there's no, yeah, way lower than that. Just not an
so you're
movie.
Saying 72?
No.
Like you see
dumb. All right, fine.
I don't care. Guess again. I don't care.
Yeah.
Take three guesses.
Denzel's probably the kind of actor that could demand just like $30 million flat for anything.
I'm gonna say $30 million.
$30 million.
$40 million.
Wes, with his revised number, is closer. 36 is exactly half of what you said.
I know, right? See, it's exactly half, though. Still oddly accurate.
So, what do you think it grossed?
Did this movie make its money back, I wonder? So it ended up being 36 million.
So that's a beat 72 mil.
Do you think people in England thought this was science fiction because of what they're talking about with the healthcare system?
Maybe, but you know they're gonna fucking find out if they keep on letting their conservative party try to privatize their healthcare. They're gonna fucking.
They're gonna eat that shit.
Yep. Let's see. No, I don't think this movie made its money back. $30 million.
$40 million.
You guys are way off. 102.
Ooh. Okay. Yeah, Denzel, bigger draw than Schwarzenegger, apparently.
I think prior to this, he did Training Day, and everybody was all aglow about him in that movie.
See, yeah. if you triple mine, then you got it. So I'm still oddly accurate.
No, that's not accuracy.
Not like Training Day was huge for him. He was really big at the time. Him and Gen X legend Ethan Hawke. Mm.
guest appeared on that Alanis Morissette album.
Hall of Famer Ethan Hawke. Hall of Famer 90s Gen Xer. Okay.
Him and Winona Ryder.
Right. I've got Peter Pan Return to Neverland.
I don't have that one. Was that in theaters or direct to DVD?
Interesting story behind it. Yes, it was in theaters.
Hmm.
So as you, I'm sure, are aware...
Fucking 40 years after the original or something? 50 years?
Yeah, so these types of movies typically don't make their way to the theater.
Right.
Like a Return of Jafar or whatever. These are typically like...
Lion King 2.
Yeah. So apparently, and I don't have all of the notes about it in front of me, but as I understand, essentially there were three major production studios at the time for Disney. One of them had closed. And because of that, they had... migrated some of the work that needed to be done to one of the more professional, but they're all professional, but one of them, the more
prestigious.
The more prestigious animation studios took hold of this one. And as a result, because of the increased budget and all of this stuff about it, they were like, okay, well, we'll just put this one out in theaters. And I'm sure they also saw that in February is a whole lot of trash and maybe some space to fill up with a kid's film that might make up a couple of bucks.
We can go toe-to-toe with Big Fat Liar.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's the logic. The premise, by the way, is that it's set in World War II. And is it Wendy? Wendy's the girl from the first one?
Yeah.
She's now a mom, and she's got a kid. And Captain Hook kidnaps her kid and takes her back to Neverland. And then Peter Pan teaches her how to fly and gets her back home to her mom. And then everyone's like, hey, real cool, it sucks about World War II, bye.
it sucks about the Nazis.
This was a brisk, by the way, this is a theatrical release that is flat 70 minutes.
Oof.
And even then, it's kind of tired. It's kind of a tired narrative, and you're just sort of like, alright, this thing will be over soon, right? It's got a couple of good numbers in it, and you know what? The fucking animation is really strong in this. Like, it's actually really, really good. I'm amazed at what they did for what they spent on a movie like this. Like, it's actually really, really impressive. So yeah, 44%. This is, aside from Monsoon Wedding, which we're not talking about, sadly, but a 44% makes this the highest reviewed movie of the month.
All right.
So that's how bad it was.
Barely a feature length.
But yeah, and again, it's the result of this whole production studio shuffling that allowed it to happen. What was the budget?
I have no idea.
That might be a good guess. I'm bad at animated movies. I'll go a little bit higher, but I'll leave some space.
I'm bad with all movies. I guess 72.
Do you want a point of reference?
Sure.
The last Disney animated film that came out in theaters was...
Emperor's New Groove.
$100 million budget for that.
Dear God.
Was it really?
108, as I recall.
That's a movie that also restarted a couple of times.
But this is also a weird sequel.
I'll go higher. I'll leave a lot of space. I'll say 45 million.
What do you got? What's your budget?
He said 12.
We'll go with that.
I think he's closer. 20 million.
Okay.
On $20 million.
I actually said 8, so you win that one.
So, what do you think he made at the box office?
Oh, this movie probably made some money.
21 million.
It's a Disney anime movie. I'm going to go higher. I'm going to go a lot higher. I'll say $80 million.
It actually made $116 million. Insane.
Yeah.
Insane return on this one. Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. Oh my God.
Why didn't that become a bigger franchise? Whew. Where's the Peter Pan extended universe?
No, there is. Just later on, he comes back and marries her and then has kids and then Hook captures the kids. And then Robin Williams makes weird noises for the entire movie.
Actually, in Hook, he marries Wendy's granddaughter.
Yeah. Oh, granddaughter, not daughter.
Rats. Yeah. And then Rufio comes in, and everyone's super impressed. Everyone's like, we should be fucking that guy.
Wasn't it Bob Hoskins?
Bob Hoskins, Dustin Hoffman?
Two of them should have been the whole movie.
Right.
Those two just palling around.
I mean, it was called Hook.
Right, they knew where the money was being made.
He's like, I'll shoot myself, Smee. He's like, stop me, Smee.
Don't try to stop me. Fucking stop me.
Don't fucking do it, Smee. And there's the same with the scorpions. That messed me up as a kid.
Oh, yeah, the box. The box. Yeah, that was fucked up.
Jeez.
And
then the food fight?
Oh. They all hallucinated together. Somebody, like, they were smoking something really fucked up.
Yeah.
Isn't that a movie you guys are generally negative about? But we have so many fun memories.
I mean, it's not a good movie, but it's really a good memorable movie. It's not a good movie. It's a really memorable movie.
What people say about it specifically is that it's kind of like a you had to be there kind of movie, like Snakes on a Plane. That it's like, if you were a 90s kid, you would probably love the shit out of Hook. If you were 40 in 1990 and you watched that, you would probably be like, oh my god, this is so stupid.
It's like the weird inverse of Phantom Menace. When that movie came out, like, this is utter trash. And now people are weirdly nostalgic for it. People seeing it for the first time was like...
That's a really good comparison, actually.
That's not an alright movie. It is not.
I was generally okay with Phantom Menace. The other two are absolute hot garbage.
Mm.
Alright. Just bring up the director of it. It's a guy named Donovan Cook who has never directed anything else.
Oh, no.
It's Rob... No.
Yeah, I mean, still thinking about if books. I were him, I'd be like, you give me a dollar, I'll turn it into $6. Like, that's my last return on investment for a
film. Maybe he didn't want to direct. Maybe he went back into, like, production design or something.
I mean, yeah, that actually is what I saw mostly on his credits was something about... Was things about associated with, like, art design and storyboarding and things like that, so... He clearly, this is a studio job, and I think that they had to put a name on it, so he got picked. They probably had a raffle over
who gets to be director now?
Okay. No, Steve, you were director last week, all right? No.
Nobody wanted to direct anything at Disney because, for some reason, around that time, Sting was just walking around with a bunch of cameras.
Oh, that's true. Okay.
And a gun.
Obviously.
So the next movie I have is Super Troopers.
Yep. That's what I got next on the list, too.
Yeah, directed by Jay Sharkhsekhar. I'm probably pronouncing that terribly.
He's one of the actors in the movies, too.
He's one of the troop. He's one of the Broken Lizard troop that made this movie.
Right. Was this the first Broken Lizard movie?
I believe so.
I know this one and Club Dread.
And Club Dread, I know about.
Beer Fest?
Super Troopers 2.
That's right.
There's a Beer sequel. Fest. Stupid.
Well, you know, a lot of these movies are kind of based on stupidity. But with something like Club Dread...
Club Dread's genuinely good.
Super Troopers, I think they had better material to work with. Like, when you're just making a stupid movie about drinking beer, like, you kind of can get what you pay for there.
Yeah.
Of course it's stupid.
Yeah.
So
this is one of those movies that I bet you in my lifetime I have seen 7 or 8 times at least.
Same.
And I rewatched it just for the sake of, you know, remembering it all. And I think that's the only thing, I'm not coming away negative about this movie, I think that's the only thing is just that I've seen the jokes so many times that part of me maybe forgot why it was funny.
Hmm.
But that said, when it hits, there's some really, really funny moments in it. It's just good sketch comedy with a bunch of guys, just a guy, you know. It's like, I feel like all of the other comedies that you see coming out, especially in this era, are of the Will Ferrell or Adam Sandler variety, where they're putting on a character, like a Zoolander character, or
it's like gross out stuff, like an American Pie or something.
Yeah, it's nice to see something where everyone's just normal people and they're just having fun.
Just normal idiots who are supposed to enforce the law.
Chugging maple syrup.
Yeah, what a great moment. Like, you remember the person that looked like spit and he's like, ah, fuck it, and he just eats the burger anyway. You know, there's
that's like the thing.
Bite it, make him look like a prick, bite it, and he's like, I'll bite the goddamn soap.
I think that's like the thing about the movie, is it's just like...
I take it back, I love this movie.
It's very quotable, it's very memeable.
Yeah, it is.
But
move that gigantic cotton candy. Like, all of these great lines.
But yeah, it's a bit like Wet Hot American Summer in that way. Like, Wet Hot American Summer is like a bit even more absurdist. But it's still just like the...
Thank you for introducing me to that movie, too.
What an amazing movie.
That movie is so great.
Yeah.
I need to rewatch it. That was really good.
Yeah. It has some Office and Community vibes as well to it. I feel like that those shows maybe took some... I would not be the least bit surprised if there was some inspiration from something like this. Again, the sort of mundane lives of just... state troopers,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, I think we've described a couple of movies now with a tortured premise. This is something where just a very simple premise and just the silly things that can happen just out of ordinary proceedings and how they try to entertain themselves in a mundane situation.
Yeah, a budget shortfall for them that they have to true up by basically just ticketing more people and they don't want to do it because they're fucking around.
That's, yep.
And Brian Cox. Brian Cox is delightful.
Now, what's he doing in this movie?
Oh, he's isn't he the best. I've never seen such a fun over it. Boss.
Oh, he's the boss then.
Yeah. Anything more you guys want to say about it?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. What did it cost to make?
Oh, God.
This movie is cheap. This movie does not cost a lot.
15.
4 million.
3.
Oh!
And we'll talk about the box office, but I got one little footnote on the box office, too. What is the box office?
100. I think this is... No.
I'm going to go lower.
No. Probably more like 50.
You're going to say 50.
I'm going to say 50.
I'm going to go lower. 35.
23.
Okay.
Doesn't sound that great. Still, that's almost a $10 return.
Yeah.
It made $60 million in rentals and DVD.
Mm.
It is a incredibly successful...
Oh, I thought that's what we were talking about.
Word of mouth film.
We were talking about the rentals and DVD.
Sure.
Add them up. That's what it was. This is pretty close to the pin.
I had two dead on and a bunch of just way the fuck off.
Yeah. All right. Well, we had the appetizers, you know, we had the salad and the soup and some breadsticks. That's nice. Let's talk about the main course.
Oh, here we go.
Rain of Fire.
Oh, God. What up?
I actually was confused there what you were talking about and then...
So, second best movie release this month, aside, of course, from Monsoon Wedding. We're just going to assume that's the best one.
Directed by Rob Bowman, famously a TV director. He did the X-Files movie, and he also did Elektra.
Oh, amazing.
All right. So, yeah, he's there doing it. He's making shit happen.
That also had dragons in it.
Yeah, sure enough, I guess.
I mean, I
Ben Affleck has a big dragon tattoo on his back.
Oh, that's right, yeah. So him and Damon got the matching ones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously?
No. Maybe. I don't know.
I've never seen his back.
They cut them
maybe off. It's a snake. Ben Affleck does have a giant tattoo on his back.
Does he really?
Yeah, for real.
Okay.
I kid you not.
I'm Googling this shit right now. You're welcome to look it up.
We're talking about Rain of Fire.
Yeah, we sure are. So we got Batman. We got King Leonidas. Christian Bale and Gerard Butler. We got
the Phantom.
Just typing in Ben Affleck, the third thing is back tattoo.
Tremendous. That's what he's
doing. Is it a dragon? What is it?
Oh, shit. No, it's like a phoenix. It's like somehow a big-ass bird.
Yeah. Well, he did that.
Or a peacock? Is that a peacock?
This isn't good for radio.
So, this movie...
I don't care. This is everything.
Matthew McConaughey. The premise is in 2003 or something. At some point, like what was contemporary when the movie came out... there's some sort of drilling or mining happenstance that awakens a dragon in the earth. It had been asleep there for thousands of years. Somehow still survived. Whatever.
Mining happenstance.
Yeah. the dragon comes in. Now there's millions of dragons. And they're all over the earth. And they're like fucking burning everything because they eat ash or something is the way that they survive, whatever. They're just
watch this
hell bent on destruction, these things. And it doesn't matter if you're trying to grow tomatoes, Christian Bale, they're going to fucking find you and burn those tomatoes. Christian Bale, Gerard Butler, they live in a castle now, as they should. They probably do in real life too.
Together. I forgot Gerard Butler's in this.
Yeah. And they
with a handful of like a ragtag group of survivors, mm-hmm. just trying to get by, not pacifists, not trying to duke it out with the dragons.
Right. Right,
just sort of trying to wait this thing out.
Yeah, hopefully there's
because the dragon will die eventually, right? I assume if it's out of food at some point.
Right, it's been alive for 1,000 years. You know it doesn't have much left in it.
Right, if they stay hidden long enough, eventually the dragons burn the entire planet. They run out of food. I think is what they're hoping for, of course, like they get found and they have to like continually try to like, okay, they found us this time. Maybe we'll grow some more tomatoes and they won't find us next time. But they're there, like you said, they have their ragtag group. They've taken in a bunch of orphans, you know, for the added sympathy. And they stay up late at night and regale them with stories of Star Wars and pretend like they made it up. Yeah. It's great. It's charming. And then like one day, fucking the American military shows up. And they're in England, of course, because Christian Bale is very English. And it's Matthew McConaughey, and he's got, like, a tank, and he's got helicopters. Yes. And you wonder how they've managed to keep all this fuel for the past 20 years.
Fucking McConaughey as a...
Like an and he's bald, and he's got a beard, and he's fucking ripped, and he's got an axe, and he's ready to fuck up some lizards. So, he's... So they show up, and, like, that's when you get, like, the exposition on... like they're like, at odds with each other. Like, I don't like you, you don't like me, but maybe we can learn to get along, but we want to kill each other.
I got this axe that I carry around for no reason.
And then Matthew McConaughey, like, gives the exposition. Like, yes, there's dragons, but we can kill them, and we know how. And we think that...
There are enough bodies at
them. We've never killed a male. So these dragons, obviously, they're like fish. There's one male, and it fertilizes the eggs. And he turned out to be right. They got it right on their first guess. Very impressive. Mm-hmm. And then in the back, like, third of the movie, that's what they're trying to do. They're going to go to London, because, of course, it's in London. They're going to go kill the king dragon. Because if they kill the king, there's no more new dragons. They can't fertilize the dragon eggs anymore, so they'll all just have fresh dragon omelets. And they'll... Stay with me, Wes.
We just fix the food shortage.
Yeah, they fix the food shortage. Oh, and it turns out that they're right. Like, if they just waited them out, they probably would have been fine, because when they get to London, the dragons are, like, cannibalizing each other because there's not much food left. So...
So Christian Bale was fucking right.
Right, right, but so was McConaughey, because when they kill the male dragon, like, of course, they can't make any more dragons. These are a species that produces sexually. You need a male and a female of the species. So they have, like, crossbows that fire missiles, and there's explosions and shit, and Matthew McConaughey leaves on a fucking building swinging an axe right into the dragon's mouth, because that's the weak point. They're weak on the inside. That's where we fucking cut them.
Meat is meat. Like, that logic never makes any fucking sense.
It's just like the X-Men logic. Like, anytime Wolverine needs to kill the Hulk, which he's done a million times,
he goes,
like,
inside of him.
Right. He just lets fucking Hulk eat him, and then, like, rebuilds himself inside the stomach and kills him from the inside. But, like, the dragons are, like, they're, like, alligators, or they're, like, armored. And alligators are dinosaurs, and dragons are dinosaurs, probably. Maybe.
My lord. I'm just imagining if alligators could fly. What a terrible state. They
have, like, hummingbird wings. Like, they don't fly, they hover. That's all they can do.
Just his tiny little arms just dangling in the air.
I mean, but, like, the production of value of this movie is impressive.
Yeah, I mean, for admittedly, for as kind of ugly and gray and cloudy as everything is.
So
there's
gray.
No color in this fucking movie until fire comes out
except,
at you.
Except for McConaughey's performance.
Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. That's who he did there.
He's tremendous.
Yeah. You really do gotta love how hard he hams it up in this film. Yeah.
He tries harder than everybody else in this movie.
Everyone plays this movie with such a straight face, and it's amazing because it's so fucking silly.
Christian Bale and Gerard Butler, they are so sincere in this movie. Like, at no point does anyone think, like, oh my god, we're making a science fiction film about dragons.
Right.
We didn't even get the plot. We didn't even get, like, dragons are typically in fantasy films. Mm-hmm. This is a science fiction film about dragons.
Right.
I'm on board.
Right?
There's not enough of that. Let's bring fantasy shit into modern day. There's not enough of that.
Oh, man. I mean, it's like Star Wars is technically a fantasy film, so I guess this is sort of a science fiction film. It all balances out.
Yeah, this is Star Wars of 2002.
I don't know.
It's the weirdest way to ever describe Rain of Fire. Rain of Fire is just to balance out Star Wars.
I think it works.
Well, and that you need to cross-pollinate the mechanics of science fiction and fantasy. And that, you know, you gotta have a little bit of one with the other. I mean, I don't know. It's such a weird movie, and it is funny at times, but ultimately, I don't know. It's,
how do they bring the dragons out of the sky? Like, they parachute out of helicopters.
Oh, yeah, and they're all, like wearing, like, flight suits. Right? Yeah. They're supposed to, like, you try to use nets in order to ensnare. Like, if it can't flap its wings, eventually it's going to, like, land on the, like, it's going to crash into the ground, and that's when they go fucking try to beat it up. Like, they have people wait, but they have to triangulate his position. They're, like, so, like, there are points of really forced drama in this. Like, right, like, when you're seeing them try to take down the first dragon when McConaughey shows up, he's like, we gotta get the things in the ground to triangulate his position. Fucking look up. There it is.
You can hear the damn thing screeching.
Right. Like, there's
a giant ball of fire in the sky. That's it.
There is, like, no point throughout that whole hunt where they're they're super unsure of where it is, but yet it becomes a big thing. Like Christian Bale has to like get on his horse and make sure that the stake is in the ground so they can triangulate its position. I don't know if they were going to try to like shoot a missile at it or what they were going to try to do, but it just seemed like, now we'll get our guys in flight suits to go out there and be fucking bait, put it in a net, and they don't even like, fucking give them parachutes.
And they kill the king dragon with a like a gas tank in its mouth, and it says, "Smile, you son of a bitch," and he explodes, right?
Yeah, like in Resident Evil 2. The Resident Evil 2 end.
I was quoting Jaws.
Yeah. And I was taking it to Resident Evil 2, which is...
Now we ruined this joke. I ruined it again.
An amazing game.
But it's something like that. He shoots something and it explodes.
Yeah, they blow it up.
Which doesn't make sense. It's a fucking dragon.
What's the problem? I think it still explodes.
It breathes fire.
Right, but...
Well, it shoots a liquid that immolates.
Is that what
so
it is?
So it's not fire?
I think they do like have a couple of lines
there was
of dialogue.
A whole thing there was a whole thing on Wikipedia where they were talking about the science of how this dragon works and like how other different properties have utilized the mechanics.
That's a great way to spend our time.
It is a great way to spend our time.
In the same way that like, what are those giant fucking terrifying like lizard monsters that like eat bison and stuff? And they bite
Komodo dragons.
Komodo dragons, and
they eat bison.
The first bite is to poison them.
It's because of no fucking joke. They are not to be reckoned.
Yeah,
trifled with.
Not to be trifled with.
Damn it!
Hang on.
Edit
it. Let's do another take.
They are not to be trifled with.
That is true. You don't trifle with a Komodo dragon.
So that's what they do. They bite.
Do they even live on the same continent? Komodo dragon and bison.
Oh, whatever the large bovine creatures are.
Maybe like a water buffalo or something.
Why are you putting me on?
Everybody's got a water buffalo.
It's in Detroit. We're in Detroit, and. They're there. So they bite them, and then what they do is they just trail them. It's a poison in there. It's a toxin in there, and then they just follow them, and when they fall asleep or fall asleep, they fall unconscious, they just eat them.
Mm.
So, that
would... they're not in Rate of Fire.
That's supposed to be the inspiration.
I think that would have been a better movie, though.
Komodo
dragons.
No. Like a better movie is like watching a lizard follow something around until it passes out. That's not a good movie.
Yeah, you're joking. Yeah, I'm joking. Rate of Fire was perfection.
I think that there was a lot of effort put into trying to make this make sense, and it didn't deserve it. This is so silly.
Well, I think like they probably would have... They don't spend a ton of time trying to do exposition, but if they had like cut that even more to just maybe a couple lines of dialogue, just don't think about it. We're just going to get in this helicopter and ensnare it in the net. We don't have to explain how we're going to do it. Just go.
We're going to follow it down to the planet.
Just fucking watch.
Start beating it with sticks.
Fucking watch us fail at this. That's the thing. Like, it's one of the weird logical fallacies. Like, oh yeah, we hunt these dragons. We do this. We're going to trap it in a net. And the one time they show them doing it, they fucking fail at it.
Yeah.
Well, don't they have a name like they're like
Minutemen or something?
Minute or something like that.
17
like,
seconds.
I think that, if like I remember it correctly, they said that this was originally like a group of 120 soldiers, and now they're down to like 8 or something.
Mm. So and like, they killed 2 dragons.
Yeah, this is like it. This is all that's left. This is like the last gasp of the U.S. military fighting force, and it's just presumed England just gave up on the idea and was like tomatoes.
Yeah. What else do we need to address about this?
Oh boy,
I mean, perfect, marvelous cinematic experience.
This is a gem of a movie.
It is.
Pumps for the sequel.
They should fucking do a sequel. They should.
McConaughey's not above it. He's too busy hawking Lincolns right now to notice what's going on. Don't
they,
throw it.
They go back to a flashback with him clawing himself out of the dragon's guts.
No. Oh, wow.
With the axe.
Bring back McConaughey?
Yeah, bring him back. Let's go.
I think Rain of Fire 2, Rain Harder or whatever. We'll get John McTiernan, who is looking for work again.
Well, he's there.
He could do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, this movie is... it's so entertainingly silly. But you can't take this movie seriously. It's not meant to be taken seriously, even though they take themselves so seriously.
Oh, yeah, they do.
They really do. I mean, even like the shitty Godzilla one that they made in the 90s had some punchy lines. It was clearly played for laughs at moments.
Mm.
This movie finds no humor in anything and instead wants to immerse us in the post-apocalypse where there's dragons.
Right.
It's like, God, what are you doing? Come on. And why did they agree to this? What?
Because they saw the script and said, this is gold.
Christian Bale was like, I just did American Psycho.
Let's do that dragon sci-fi movie.
Do that shit. Oh my god. Oh well.
I wouldn't be surprised if they filmed this one first and was just in post. Because, yeah. Like, it's legitimately, like, the effects are good. Like, it's a nice-looking movie.
I mean, admittedly, I think that they do pull off the sequences pretty well. Well, yeah, I don't know. It's a weird one, that's for sure. Oh, what do you think the budget was?
Oh, God. You go first this time. I've been going first.
That thing's got to be an expensive movie. $80 million. $80.
60.
60 million.
What?
Triple threat over here.
Oh, shit.
On the money.
Hat trick. All right, what is
that? That made me feel good.
What's the box office?
250 million. No, just this is a gem.
If there's any justice in the world, $1 billion.
This and that one movie makes that $2.
Wait, what are you saying?
The other movie you said earlier. I'm referencing back an old joke. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Wait, what are you saying for this movie, though? Box office.
God, I don't know. I don't know if this would make its money back.
I think it had to. I think it had to make its money back.
I'll go 100. Why not?
I'm going to go a little bit lower. I'll go 80. I'll stick with 80.
82.
Okay.
Pretty close.
Yeah.
You don't get the alarm bells. So you don't get
any. I haven't been on the money yet.
Yeah, no sparklers or fireworks for you. But still, you know, hey, this movie made its money back.
Sure did.
Clearly the start of what should be a franchise.
How come Dragonheart got like fucking 4 sequels and Reign of Fire got none?
Yeah, soundtrack slaps.
That's true.
Okay, one quick movie to get out of the way. Dragonheart also,
Did this soundtrack slap or was it Dragonheart?
Oh, Dragonheart's got an amazing soundtrack.
I don't know that this movie had a soundtrack. It's not like a score.
It's just McConaughey just yelling.
A pretty forgettable score. This just had like an R&B track with Bale and McConaughey.
Yeah. One to just kind of get out of the way. I don't know if you know much about Dragonfly.
I don't.
Okay, yeah. Dragonfly, it had a 7%.
Oh, no.
It had a 7%. It's a Kevin Costner film. Generally, the premise is that like this doctor whose wife is dead... his wife is communicating through his patients experiencing near-death experiences. So, like, they're about to die or something, and then his wife visits them.
It is just a month of tortured premises.
I know. It's so bad. It looks so terrible. Yeah. I'll just tell you the budget, because I don't really want to get into it, but it's $60
million. All right.
And it made 52.
They could have made, like, 3 Fields of Dreams.
And the director is Tom Shadaic, who did, like, Bruce Almighty and Liar Liar.
All right.
How strange.
I know. It's like it's supposed to be the psychological thriller. Oh, my God. Last movie I got, and I think you watched this one, Queen of the Damned.
I did.
Yeah.
How'd that go?
Oh, it was a train wreck, but fascinating.
Oh, I watched it too, yeah.
You cannot look away from this movie. Like, I couldn't, like, pause it and walk away to, like, take a break if I tried. Like, what a ride this movie was. It is a sequel to Interview with the Vampire. I don't know the name of our lead actor. I didn't recognize any. Oh, wait.
Stuart Townsend?
I mean, there are some recognizable names in this movie.
This is a posthumous film featuring Aaliyah, who had died, I think, the previous year.
Yeah.
In a plane crash. This is the second film. I forgot. I didn't remember what the other one was, but I think we talked about another film she was in just prior to this.
Maybe Romeo Must Die?
Yes. Yes, that was it.
But yeah, it's... She doesn't really have a ton of screen time. Which is kind of weird because she's the title character. But sequel to Interview with the Vampire, our lead character is Lestat, who is the Tom Cruise character.
Stuart Townsend.
Yes. And he wakes up from some sort of hibernation and decides to join a metal band in order to draw...
To get the attention of all of the other... vampires who are also undercover,
right.
Basically, who want to remain dormant and off the grid, essentially.
And kind of calling them out in order to
do something. The dulcet sounds of nu metal.
Right. Right.
Oh, man.
And yeah, and he becomes like this instant like a public figure, public star, because like he joined a band of a bunch of nobodies. Like reveals himself to be a vampire and has groupies and and our female lead from Wet Hot American Summer is the female lead in this movie.
Was it Marguerite Monroe?
Yeah, I think
that's it. Katie from Wet Hot American Summer. Wow.
Yep. Okay, what were your thoughts on this one?
It's so of its time. Mm-hmm. It really is so of its time. I don't know what's so weird about it is that your big draw is that it's Aaliyah, and then there's no Aaliyah-like music in it at all. It's a soundtrack entirely of nu metal. Like, if I can get the track list here, this is like a heavy hitters list. Oh, including the fact that Jonathan Davis is the singing voice. Jonathan Davis is the singer for the band Korn.
Mm.
So he's the singing voice of Lestat for all of this nu metal shit that's happening there.
Right. The entire time I'm watching the movie is like, are they just playing Korn music throughout the entire thing?
Yeah, I mean, you're getting Static X, Dry Cell, Papa Roach is in here, Disturbed, Deftones. Like, these were some of the biggest new metal bands of this era making this movie.
Like, all the bands that turned Woodstock 99 into a terrible experience.
Yeah. Oh, and the whole thing is that, so apparently Anne Rice had given the rights to this to the studio that made it. I forget what studio even made it, but it was loaned to them that they had a certain time frame to produce the film, and if they didn't get it done by a certain point, the rights would return to her. And basically they rushed this whole job at the last minute to try to get a film out using this copyrighted material that they had. So, obviously it went terribly. This has, Interview with the Vampire is really good. I enjoy that movie. I think it's fun, and it probably helps the fact that you have so many amazing actors in it, and that it's just kind of a cool story.
Yeah, it's just like an interesting, history that you're moving through.
But yeah, it's probably the same thing as watching Lionheart and then thinking that Reign of Fire is the sequel to it. You know, it's so terrible. Like, ugh. Anyway, I don't know. I think it's pretty comically bad. It's got some fun moments in it, I guess. But all in all, it's pretty. It's not sexy enough. It's too nu metal-y. It's not violent enough. It doesn't really. You don't get the cool, sleek, sexy appeal of vampires the way that you're supposed to. It's also stupid, and like the idea that they want right. to resurrect this. That's the idea, is that they want to resurrect Akasha. And the idea is that there's always supposed to be this male and female vampire that are the dominant force on Earth. And the male god vampire kills himself. So the idea is that they're trying to bring just her back? Like, I don't... To do what? Why? What's the... Right. All she wants to do the second she comes back alive is just kill everything.
Right. So... Through a lot of the movie, you're kind of wondering, like, what is at stake?
Like, what's he getting out of this?
Right, and what is it that's motivating a lot of these characters to do anything? Lestat and our female lead. It's hard to distinguish, like, what it is that makes him so magnetic that people are drawn to him, and then what it is that they're hoping to get out of having him be this exalted figure.
Yeah.
And then, like, in the end, like, they resurrect the queen, and he just ends up changing his mind, and they'll try to kill her.
Yeah, basically they end up killing her again.
And nothing was accomplished. Some people die, and everyone moves on. Oh, our female lead becomes a vampire. Oh, great.
Good for her.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
How come this never got a sequel?
I didn't. Let's get to the numbers.
Yeah.
Budget? Do you care to guess the budget?
40. Yeah.
I don't know. I think I might go lower. I'll go 30.
Splitting the uprights, fellas. It's 35.
Mm.
Ooh.
What did it make?
God, $10, hopefully. One person went to see it.
60.
You think it made its money? Okay, Ethan. Yeah. I'm actually wondering. I'm wondering if it made its money back. You say 60 million. I think I'm going to go lower. I think I'm going to go 50.
45.
Okay. Even look good.
Yeah, so that's why they didn't make a sequel. It wasn't very successful, and the main character life passed.
Hmm.
So, again, I think if not for the fact that Aaliyah was in this, this would be such a forgettable movie. Nobody would care about this thing existing.
Hmm. Nobody should. It's bad.
Yeah, I mean, other than Rollerball, it's the lowest box off grossing movie. Like, I mean, Super Troopers made 23, but on a budget of $3 million, like, crazy.
Mm.
Like, this is a absolute footnote.
Yeah. As with a lot of these movies, a lot of stinkers. A couple of movies that are at least enjoyable to watch, but nothing that was a particularly good film.
I think better films will await in March.
Dare you speak bad of Rain of Fire? How dare you, sir?
The Rain of Fire is a delight.
It really is. A gem.
But probably not for the reasons they were hoping for. Anything else we need to address before we're done here?
No, I think we're done. This is another marathon.
Cool. So next up is going to be the official show. We've got some new games and stuff to talk about. Wes, you're back into Fire Emblem.
I got past Chapter 5. Mm. I did it.
I am right at the end. The final mission becomes accessible, but there you can like do skirmishes and stuff, and we can get into that. So I've been spending a lot of time just messing around and leveling up characters. So we'll have a good discussion about Fire Emblem, and I'm hoping to go through the Octopath demo, so we can talk a little bit about that one as well.
Yep.
But it'll be a good one.
Yep.
And then we'll start up with the Pokemon show in March. That's it. That's the end.
So long.
See ya.